Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime analyst on A&E Network's police documentary show, Live PD. On today's episode of PD Stories, I interview a former Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police officer who was one of the first African-Americans to ride side-by-side with white officers. We will also discuss his experiences as an undercover narcotics detective during the height of D.C.'s drug epidemic in the 1980s. David, welcome to PD Stories.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
You started in 69. What caused you to decide to become a police officer?
Oh, well, first of all, let's just say I got sworn in 69, and what got me going was, all honesty, I was down at Norfolk State University, and I had a, what they call a 2S draft deferment. That was a student deferment. Well, the war started heating up, and my 2S got snatched and changed to a 1A, which meant I was draft bait, you know. Yeah, so when I came home, I was, you know, I kind of saw the handwriting on the wall. So I went downtown to the Marine Corps recruiting station and talked to the recruiting sergeant down there. And he offered an opportunity for me to get involved in the 120-day delayed enlistment program. So I said, well, look, let me talk to my cousin first, and I'll get back with you, because I just had a cousin who had just got out of the Marine Corps. But before I left there, he did ask me, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, I used to watch a lot of news reports. Especially, I was very fond of watching Walter Cronkite on the channel on the CBS News. And he would have nuclears from Vietnam of helicopters flying around. I said, wow, that really looks cool, flying a helicopter. So I told the Marine Corps sergeant that I want to fly helicopters. And so he said, we can arrange that, because we do have a shortage of helicopter personnel. I said, but I still want to talk to my cousin first, though. So he said, okay. So I went home and called my cousin. And the first thing my cousin asked me was, did you sign anything? I said, no, I didn't sign anything. He said, well, what did you all talk about? What did he say? Well, so I told him, I wanted to enlist, a possibility that I wanted to enlist. And that when I did, I wanted to fly helicopters. And he said that they could arrange that because they had a shortage. So my cousin asked me, did he tell you why they had a shortage? He said, no, he didn't. He said, because they're all getting shot down. So I called a recruiting sergeant back and told him I wasn't interested after that. But then I bumped into a friend of mine who was a police cadet. He said they were hiring, you know, because this is shortly after the April riots of 1968. Also, the police department was pretty white at the time, and some of the brutality incidents weren't as bad as maybe down in the South, but we still had them up here in D.C. So after the 1968 riots that followed the King assassination, they had a big push to get more African Americans on the police department. So
so you joined?
Yeah, my friend told me about it, and at the time they had little trailers where you could take the test. Located all over the city. So they had one trailer down there on George Avenue and Gallatin Streets, Northwest. So I went down there and took the test, passed it. And then they gave me a date to come back for my physical. So I came back for the physical, passed it. And then they gave me sent me a letter of mail saying that they were going to do a background investigation. So they did the background investigation. This is back in the day. They didn't have computers and all. They actually had to go door to door, make phone calls, you know, and actually talk to people face-to-face.
How deep are your roots in D.C.? Are you a...
Born and raised. All my parents and grandparents were born in the South. Richmond, Norfolk, Virginia, Roanoke, Danville. A couple of my aunts came up here. They got jobs in the D.C. school system. And then my parents came up here. My father came up here after World War II. And went to Howard on the G.I. Bill for a while. And that's where you met my mother.
Now, David, are you the first person in your family to become a police officer?
Actually, my brother had joined the police department as a police cadet. And he was actually on before I was. I followed him shortly thereafter. But because of my age, I went on as an officer as opposed to a police cadet.
Now, let's get to talking about your work in the streets once you were sworn in and hit the streets of Washington, D.C. and actually started policing. Now, you went to the 9th Precinct first, right?
Yes, after I got out of the police academy, I was assigned to number 9 Precinct, which is located 5th District, which is in the area of 8th and H Street, northeast.
Was that an all-white precinct when you came in?
Well, no, it wasn't all white. It was very white, let's say, and they did have some black officers there. But there was some tension because the black and white officers did not ride together in the scout cars. And so there's some of the officials there. They were very racist. And at the time, but number 9 had the reputation, I guess, of being almost Ku Klux Klan headquarters. At that time. And when I first got there, the scout cars were not integrated.
Did you have any particular problems with people?
No, not really. They didn't associate you with us too much.
Now, what was it like when you first started hitting the streets and actually, enforcing the law in Washington, D.C. and dealing with criminals and so forth? Kind of take me into your initial rookie year, if you will.
Okay, well, I first got there, of course, I had to, by being the low man on the totem pole, every dirt assignment that came down the pike, I got it. And so weekdays, I would walk the beat, either 8th Street, Benning Road, other parts of the 5th District. And the older black officers, they did take an interest in us. Mm. And they did everything in their power to basically show us the ropes and keep us out of trouble. And two in particular, Richard Pennington and Willie Doster. One night that we were working 4 to 12 shift, after we got off, they pulled us aside, and so we sat in the back of Officer Pennington's car, and they basically told us everything we needed to know about how to survive at Number 9 Precinct. They told us who to watch out for. They basically told us what our rights were as officers, because we didn't know. We were basically naive. We didn't know anything except what they had told us at the academy, which at the time wasn't really a whole heck of a lot. They basically showed us the ropes. And I think what they told me directly probably saved my career. They were very knowledgeable about basically how just survival techniques. It's about, I'm not talking about honesty. I'm talking about inside the precinct survival techniques.
When you first started in the 9th Precinct, you worked with Catherine Graham, who owned the Washington Post. You worked with her son, Donald Graham.
Yes, Donnie. Yeah, Donnie. We were in the same section. We rode together a few nights as well. Once the scout cars were desegregated, and he was a very very conscientious guy, and we knew he wasn't going to be there long because I think he was just trying to get a feel of the city since he had been groomed to run the Post after his mother retired, didn't step down. And he ran it for a long time. I think they just sold it, a couple of years ago?
Yeah. I never knew until this moment that Catherine Graham's son had been an MPD police officer.
Oh, there's a whole lot of people don't know that. But he was a good guy to work with. I used to bump into him on the street every now and then while I was out and about. And he's still the same old guy he was back in Number 9.
Now, out in the streets, what kind of crimes were you encountering in those early days in 69, 70, 71?
Oh, we had everything, assaults, thefts. We ran the whole gang. We uniform. You basically get a taste of everything because a lot of times, whatever goes down, you're the first officer on the scene, even on the scene of a major, on the scene of a murder even. You'll get there before the homicide guys get there, and you have to know how to preserve the scene, what have you, separate the witnesses and all. And so you basically it's a mixed bag. You get a taste of everything.
Do you remember the first homicide scene you came up on?
Yes, I do. It was a 1,200 block of a place called Wiley Place, which is off of 8th Street. And apparently there was a card game going on. And I guess somebody thought somebody else was cheating, and they stabbed him to death. And so I got there. I mean, it was a bloody scene. It was pretty messy. And I guess because of my upbringing, I hadn't really seen anything like this before, and it was a little unnerving at first, but, one thing I learned, you had to keep your cool and kind of keep your head while everybody else around you was losing theirs. Learn what I've been taught about preserving a crime scene, what have you, and keeping the witnesses separated, just hold on to the people from a homicide got there.
What were the neighborhoods in D.C. that you found to be the diciest and most dangerous? Now, I can name a few from my experience in Edgewood Terrace. Search mm-hmm. Quarter for certain. Montana Terrace.
Since I was over number 9, I got a taste of Montana Terrace. And then over southeast, Langston Lane. It used to be pretty rough. And we used to do some activity in Berry Farms. And then of course, you get off of Benning Road, get in Simple City. They were there in Simple City for a good reason. Because they didn't care about nothing.
No, that's a murderous clique.
Yeah. But again, like I say, you know, I learned over the years how to basically be careful and take care of myself. But, I mean, still, you know, I kind of walked through my head on a swivel, so to speak.
Now, were drugs a big problem when you first came on the force in D.C.? Or did that kind of evolve as we got more into the early 80s with crack?
Well, drugs were a problem. They've always had drugs in D.C. But the difference was it was run by the older so-called gangsters. Now, these guys, they ran it like a business. I mean, they didn't tolerate a whole bunch of murders and whatnot. But no, they were businessmen.
Guys like Linwood Gray, William Dog Turner.
Yes.
Odessa Madre, the old gangsters.
Oh, I learned about Odessa Madre. This is a little aside. Her dog bit somebody and had to go to her house and take a dog bite report years ago.
Odessa Madre was a black woman who was one of the top gangsters in Washington, D.C. from the 40s.
Yeah, I think she was a madam.
Yeah, she was a madam. And from mm-hmm. the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, Odessa Madre was legendary.
And she lived right up in the northwest, not too far from Walter Reed. So I had a chance to, you know, to bump into all those old guys occasionally. And I can tell you, unlike the new so-called gangsters that came along, these guys died of old age, and they didn't die in jail.
Dog Turner died in jail last year at the age of like 80-some years old. I knew him.
Oh, I missed him.
Yeah, I knew him. He actually, like a lot of the old hustlers, some of them never could get out of the game. He went in and came back out at 72 years old, was a fugitive for mm-hmm. heroin dealing again, and went back to prison where he eventually died. But you remember when 14th and U was a massive open-air drug market? Were you undercover?
Yep.
Were you in the undercover unit then?
No, I didn't get into narcotics until 1983. What happened was I was in court one time, and I saw one of my former lieutenants who had worked at 4th District, Lieutenant Jim Jones. We still see each other every now and then. He was telling me about this jump-out unit. I had never heard that term, jump-out, before.
Why do they call it jump-out?
Well, because, okay, you ride around in cars and coming real fast. You jump out the cars and basically arrest the perpetrators. We got the name that we got from the people on the street.
And you're in unmarked cars in plain clothes?
Unmarked and in plain clothes, mm-hmm. Yes, both.
What was the actual process of setting up a buy bust?
Oh, what you do is, first, we were given a quantity of cash, and we record the serial numbers off that money on a separate piece of paper in case that money is recovered after the suspect is captured and then searched incident to the arrest. Then, of course, we pick an area, and we go into the area to attempt to make the buy. It wasn't hard to make a buy back then. You stayed long enough, they would come to you. You didn't really have to seek anybody. They would come to you. And so we make the buy, do the hand-in exchange for the cash, for the drugs. Now, once I had the drugs, I would go back to my vehicle, and I would give a lookout to my arrest team members. And my arrest team members might consist of anywhere between 6 to 10 people. And once I gave the lookout, or lookouts, they were going back into the area I just vacated to try to find the suspect or suspects that I had purchased from. Now, once they found everybody, they were taken to a prearranged location where I could observe them without them observing me. And I would advise them of a positive or a negative. Because a positive, the first was a place of arrest and search and what have you for more drugs, more money, or more guns, or whatever. And a lot of times, if they found any money, they'd say they'd ask for the last 4 serial numbers off my pre-recorded bills. And the serial numbers matched up. Hey, that would bolster your case in court.
Did you find that a lot of those suspects, when they were caught with the marked money, pled guilty?
Yes, they did. My unit at the time, we were very credible, and we also had made very good, solid cases, so we had like a 90-plus percent conviction rate.
So you get into the jump out squad, and tell me some of your crazy experiences you had and what things were like in the streets then.
Drugs were flourishing. Well, you could get almost any kind of drugs you could think of back then. You get the PCP, you get your dangerous drugs like your Prelude, you know, which is a street name was BAM. That was a diet pill that they were used to enhance the heroin kick. We would buy those. We would buy PCP. We would buy heroin, cocaine. Crack didn't come along till later, so all the cocaine we bought was basically cocaine powder. Of course, about marijuana, lots of marijuana was out there too. So I started working undercover. I had a couple of real good training officers that showed me how to, you know, the ropes and how to do it. And so I was basically buying everything. And those certain areas were known for certain things. Our 14th and the 14th Street corridor was basically known for heroin and cocaine.
I remember when that intersection at 14th and U back in 83, 84, 85, when it was 200-300 people standing on the corner 24 hours a day doing hand-to-hand heroin sales and PCP. I'd never seen anything like that.
Oh, yeah. It was notorious, but I tell you, it was open air, and like, you know, you were actually between U Street and W Street. I mean, you walk up and down 14th Street between those. Don't leave out V Street either. V Street was pretty rough. But right on the 14th Street corridor, you walk up there, eventually, you could go to one end. By the time you got the other end, you'd have something.
Yeah, you wouldn't recognize it today. It's so cosmopolitan. But back then, 14th Street was all strip joints and pretty. It's just a seedy part of town.
Yeah, it was. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you a question about D.C. D.C. doesn't have Crips and Bloods, and we've never had those kinds of gangs like they have in Chicago and L.A. We have neighborhood crews.
Kennedy
Street crew, you know, Simple City crew. And then we have. Mm-hmm. We have the neighborhoods that basically form their own little cliques.
They're like, it's just the neighborhood kids. I guess this way they bond together to protect each other or form their drug enterprise. And of course, you know, in those crews, the leadership can change from week to week depending on who goes to jail or who gets killed or whatever. And I don't think they're as strong and as organized at all as the gangs in L.A. or other big cities. And they can hold a candle to those guys.
I know that feeling from being a police officer in Sursum Quarter in D.C. when things get really dicey and the bullets start flying in the drive-by, and it's a feeling where your blood almost turns hot in your veins. What was the diciest situation that you ever found yourself in?
There was a time I got made, and they approached me, but like I said, I just pulled my gun out. I had underneath my coat. I was pulled out and say, "Look, one step in, that's it."
So they made you. They made you as an undercover.
Yeah.
Walked a step to you, and you pulled your weapon.
Yes, I did. And they backed off after that. Now you had to be very careful because see, you go in areas like this, you know, you can't go in there thinking you're the only one that got a gun now. You know.
Right.
There were times where we found people who were also armed and dangerous in some of these areas, so we had to be very careful.
When I was SPO in Sursum Court in 2013, we had a dice game that got shot up. There were 56 shell casings at the scene, four down, one dead, and multiple weapons involved. And it was just, that was my eye-opening moment when I realized just how dangerous it was where I was working. And I was working a night shift.
Well, no, Sursum Court, and back in the day, they were famous for PCP, drive-up sales. Mm-hmm. And so we used to go to all time and get the... Love Boat.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Love Boat is the D.C. slang for PCP. And Washington, D.C. is unique in that it is the one city in America that has always had a strong, strong love affair in certain neighborhoods with PCP use. And it's been going on since the late 60s, early 70s, and it continues to this day. And police hate to encounter a person high on PCP. I've dealt with them. I'm sure you dealt with them, haven't you?
Yes. Matter of fact, I first found about PCP. I was in uniform. I wasn't working narcotics. I come upon an auto accident where, you know, just one guy rear-ended another guy. And the guy who rear-ended the vehicle, you know, got out the car with a lead pipe. He's getting ready to attack the driver of the car that he just rear-ended. And so I stepped between the two of them, and I was able to disarm the gentleman with the lead pipe. And once I did that, All of a sudden, he came at me. He was like, I'm in uniform now. I'm not working. I wasn't in that college. I was in uniform in a marked scout car and everything. And he came at me and grabbed me by my shirt. And I reacted with the first thing that was available, which turned out to be the lead pipe.
You hit him with his own lead pipe?
Yeah. Now, technically, you're technically not supposed to do that. But I reacted.
John Wayne famously said, a man's got to do what a man's got to do. And that sounds like one of those moments.
It was, and I hit him a couple of times, and I thought that might be the end of it. But when this guy came back at me, and next thing I know, we're in the middle of 2nd Missouri Avenue, rolling all over the ground now. At the time, I'm about 6'2", 160 pounds, and this guy is about 5'8", 140, and he's winning a fight.
It's superhuman strength when they're on PCP.
Yeah, I found that out. So we're rolling on the ground. I heard the sirens off in the distance. Somebody put out a policeman in trouble call. It wasn't me. It was somebody, maybe a citizen had to call it in. So about 6 more officers showed up, and they joined the fray. I mean, they did a job on this guy, but, I mean, this guy kept coming, man. You know, this. We got him handcuffed, but while he was down on the ground, he bit our canine man on his leg.
Hmm. Did you ever suffer any serious injuries during the course of your career as a police officer?
No, I did not. I was very fortunate. I never really got seriously hurt. As a matter of fact, the time I did get hurt is because of another officer. We were tussling with a suspect, and he had one of these big old flashlights. And the suspect, he was giving us a hard time, so he tried to use as a flashlight to soften him up a little bit, I guess. And he thought he was hitting the suspect, but he was hitting me. I told him so many words, man, stop hitting me, man. I'm not repeating exactly how I said it, but you get the drift.
I get the picture, yeah. Now, when you were working undercover, being from D.C., did you ever encounter people while you were undercover that recognized you? And if you did, how'd you deal with it?
Yes. If they knew me, they basically walked out the area. Nobody that I knew, like from high school or growing up, they never fingered me. But they would see me walk out the area. Now, I did a couple of trials, and some of the people who were at the trials recognized me, and they would put their finger on me. But then people they would walk away from me, but nobody ever tried to attack me. But you know. The potential for doing that was there.
Nobody ever threatened you, even?
Well, I did. I got threatened one time in the middle of a trial. I'm not going to mention this gentleman's name, but I got in a heroin buy off of him, not from the 14th Street corridor, but for another part of town. And they broke for lunch. And he was standing in the middle of Indiana Avenue threatening. You know, he said he was going to kill me and all this stuff.
That's right, in front of police headquarters.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. That's right. And the reason I took it seriously because this gentleman he had a murder charge on him previously, but it never came to trial because the star witness was killed.
Imagine that.
Yeah, how about that? And so what happened was, I was armed and everything, and I made my mind that if he came toward me, I was just going to I'm not no John Wayne type, but. I figured if he killed once, he'd kill again. I wasn't going to be the next victim.
I can
dig
it.
So I made my mind. If he came at me, I was just going to just do what I had to do. But that didn't happen. He stayed in the middle of Indiana Avenue with his threats. He never approached me.
What makes you good at fooling people as an undercover? What are the characteristics that make a good undercover?
Well, first of all, you have to be smart. You got to be able to think on your feet. As time went on in my career as a police officer, I learned how to size people up in a hurry, so to speak, as to who might be dangerous, who might not be. And, of course, also when you're working undercover, or when you walk into the area, not only are you scanning the area for people who might, you know, who you might know or who might know you, you look around for people who might be potential holders of weapons or money. Basically, try to scan everything, but now you got to do all this and still keep your mind on exactly what you're doing in reference to getting your buy and securing your lookouts of the people who you just purchased from. So you're basically doing a whole bunch of multitasking all within a short span of time.
And acting.
Oh, yeah, well, sometimes you have to act, too. Yes, that's right, yeah. or you also have to look for escape rooms just in case things go haywire.
Now, when you were an expert witness, what was the most dramatic courtroom testimony situation you found yourself in?
Oh, yeah. Oh, there was one case where I had a defendant testify against a defendant who was from Guyana. And the defense lawyer, they would use what they call a voir dire. This is where they may come and challenge your qualifications as an expert.
Mm-hmm.
This particular defense lawyer asked me if I knew where Guyana was located. I kind of looked at him and smiled and said, Dutch, British, or French? And once I said that, I could see his jaw almost hit the floor. And so I ended up telling the court that Guyana was located on the northern tip of South America, just north of Brazil, but east of Venezuela. And from that point on, I had the jury in my hip pocket. If you're an expert, you had to know where the drugs came from. Because like I said, no, we don't grow heroin over here in the United States. That stuff comes from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Mexico. You know?
Now, you were a coach at the Boys Club also back then?
Yes, number 10 Police Boys Club. I coached four seasons of basketball from 1977 to 1981.
And some of the kids that you mentored at the Boys Club went on to follow in your footsteps?
Yes, we had about three of them, maybe about four of them, actually got on the police department, and one became a pretty decent homicide detective.
And I think some of them may have gone the opposite direction, too, right? And
I'm fortunate I had that, too, yes. Matter of fact, there were times I had to testify against some of my former ball players. I've had to arrest a couple of them. And a couple of them died as a result of the drug wars. And it was some of these kids I had known since they were like 9 years old. And of course, we had them at the club. Everything was okay, you know, because they were playing basketball or football, whatever. And basically staying out of trouble. They were doing fairly decent in school, you know. Once they got out of school and, you know, if they didn't watch it, if they didn't get a job or go military or something else, they fell into that street life. And, you know, some didn't survive it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think has changed in the years since you started in D.C.? We seem to still have a lot of the same problems in high crime areas, even though the city is changing and it's really a really teeming metropolis now compared to what it was when I came there in 1980 out of college from Norfolk State. And
yeah,
it's really changed a lot. But then there's neighborhoods like Anacostia, which has a crime rate that's 253% higher than the national average right now. And what do you think is the reason that we have these pockets of crime and despair that just don't seem to go away?
Well, I think as far as kids, I think they need something to do. That's where the Boys Club would come in. But I think, these days, everybody's talking about cutting money to balance the budget and all. But when you do that, we cut some of these programs. It tells on the community because now you got a bunch of kids running around with nothing to do, and when the kid gets nothing to do, they start getting into trouble. I think that maybe some of these programs need to be enhanced or restored. I think also that I think the churches are doing pretty decent, but I think they may have to step up a little bit more. Also, I see they should have some more education programs too. I see where Kevin Durant stepped up the other day and donated $10 million, but to the neighborhood out in Suitland. There's some type of education program. I think we could use the same thing in D.C. I know we have STEM programs and all that stuff. Just get these kids interested in doing something else besides criminal activity. Because, criminal activity, let's face it, it's a one-way hole. You either end up dead or in jail.
I think kids are a lot more materialistic now, too, because ever since people started really getting into high-priced sneakers, every year we see some tragic case where some young man is killed for a new pair of sneakers. And you know, when you started out on the force in the 60s and 70s, if somebody told you that in the 90s and 2000s that people would kill people for sneakers, you wouldn't have believed it, and I wouldn't have believed it either.
Nope. I mean, all we had was those old Chuck Taylors we used to have back in the day.
We had Pro Kids, we had Chuck Taylors, and that was it.
Yep.
As you look back over the decades, What's your take on what it was like to be a cop in D.C. back then when you started in your early years of your career, and what it's like now?
I think now it's gotten a little more political now. You know, you really got to be careful what you say, careful what you do. And, of course, you know, they got the camera phones. No, they didn't have those.
Body cams?
No, not the body. Well, not only
oh,
the
you
body
just mean people having cell phones that can film whatever you do in the street?
Right, yes. Now, of course, now, if you weren't doing anything, they can film all you want to. If you're not doing it, if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, it shouldn't make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, also, I've heard that, you know, these everybody's trying to advance. So they're basically scared to make decisions because it might hurt their career. But now the officials I work for, they had a lot of courage, and they would make a decision. They would stand by it.
If you could do it all over again, would you still want to be a police officer?
Yes.
And what was your favorite part about being a police officer?
The challenge. The fact that, I was out there just doing stuff. But first of all, some people said I couldn't do. Somebody said I can't do something. I like to prove them wrong. So the challenge was my biggest thing.
Did you ever have to fire your weapon at a suspect?
No, I fired my weapon one time in 26 years, and that was at a dog. And just to show you just how, you know, you get an adrenaline fuel type situation. The dog was 3 feet away, and I missed.
You know, it's interesting you say that because a lot of people think that, you know, police just are dead shots. And it's not as easy as people think it is, even when you're trained.
Oh, no, some people say they watch too many John Wayne movies, including a certain party in the White House.
Yeah. What's your proudest moment from being a police officer?
My proudest moment was once I became an expert witness. And an expert witness, you know, I was supposed to be the Mr. Know-It-All of the drug world. I would testify at drug cases as to the methods of operations, prices, weights and measures, police procedure, you know, everything pertaining to the drug world. And I became a pretty adept at it, to the point where all my peers from the other vice units, they would call me to be the expert on their case. So I figure whenever you're recognized by the people who you work with, that's about the highest honor you can get.
What's your biggest regret from your career as a police officer?
I guess my biggest regret is I never made any rank. I had opportunity to, but I just didn't take it. I was really happy doing what I was doing. But as I look back at that I could have gone further if I really put my mind to it. But I was just having myself a good time working with my colleagues, and I felt really comfortable doing it. And a lot of times you make rank, they'll stick you behind a desk or something. And to me, I like being out there in the street. I like to you know, rub elbows and stay above what's happening, what was going on out there. And I met a lot of good people out there, really.
What advice would you give to current MPD officers in D.C. based on your body of experience?
Well, first thing is go out there, be efficient, you know, treat people the way you yourself want to be treated. Be conscientious, you know, of their situation. Like, remember, there's one thing I had to adjust to. See, I grew up in upper Northwest, and when I got down to the 9th Precinct, I saw some things I hadn't seen my whole life when I was up in Northwest. And for a while, it was a little bit of a culture shock. But so a lot of them didn't have the breaks that I had, and I had to, recognize that I was just more fortunate than them, and that this situation was not to be belittled or be sneered at, the hand life dealt them. But a lot of times, they made the most of very little. I was really just amazed at how they cope with some of the things that they had to cope with.
When you retired, did you have to kind of figure out what to do? Because all of a sudden you've had this 26-year career. You've had an adrenaline rush from many, many days at work. You've been out there armed and in the streets, and now all of a sudden you're retired. How'd you make the transition from?
Well, it took a little bit of doing, because for a while I didn't do anything. And then and I'll tell you, I would bounce around really from job to job. I worked for a job. If I didn't like it, I quit. What the heck? I was getting the check. I think I must have had maybe 6 or 7 jobs since I actually retired, and I finally landed at a job with a limo company here in the D.C. area, and I've been with them for well over 12 years now.
that's how I met you. I was going to the Critics' Choice Awards. We were nominated. Live PD was nominated for Best Unstructured Reality Series this year. And you picked me up at my house in suburban Maryland to take me to the airport to go to L.A. for the awards. And we got to talking and both realized that we've both been police officers. And so I'm really, really thrilled that I was able to have you on. And it's been a real treat to have you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris, Jr. Don't forget to watch me every Friday and Saturday night on Live PD on A&E at 9 o'clock. PD Stories is an A&E production produced in association with Audio Boom. PD Stories is executive produced and created by Sue Funk for A&E Networks.